creator, redeemer, and sustainer.
Amen.
Before I begin the sermon proper, just to let you know, indeed, it is wonderful to be back. You might recognize me. I recognize most of you from a wonderful vacation. I've told several people that it was probably the best vacation we have had since we moved here, because let's face it, 2020 wasn't much of a year for vacation, so that we crossed off the list. And then 2021, I don't know, was busy with other things to cross that off the list. But at any rate, we had a wonderful vacation. We did make it back to New Hampshire for a week to see principally our son Carter, but also other friends and acquaintances. And Becky had not been back since we moved here. So it was great. And it was just long enough that I was just starting to feel like I was retired. But not quite. So that's the mark of a good vacation. You know, you want to get that balance. So thank you. It was great, and it was wonderful, wonderfully rested, and it's just great to be back with you all. Looking forward to what's going to be a busy fall here at St. Michael's for many wonderful, wonderful reasons. There are two occasions the church observes that are inspired by our national life and not by the liturgical calendar: Independence Day and Labor Day. These two occasions provide an opportunity to think about our nation, our people, our history, what has gone well, what has not gone well, our struggles, our triumphs. Of the 2 days, Independence Day is actually a holy day, a feast day on the calendar. Labor Day is one of those, we call them sideways days. You can slide it over to where you want it to be. So on this occasion, I'm sliding it over to Tibet. They are, as I said, great days of reflection. At least I think they ought to be. My Christian perspective gets a little nervous when I hear the term American exceptionalism, but nonetheless, we are a remarkable country with a unique history. We have a diverse range of cultures, a variety of ways that Americans experience America, an imperfect union of states that is still in the experimental stage, and around all that hovers a religiosity, broadly construed for sure, that, despite a decline in the rate of church attendance and worship, is still woven into the fabric of American citizenship. So on this Labor Day weekend, while we give thanks for all those who work, we might also contemplate the larger picture of economics, government, technology, other areas that are all interconnected in our common life. And to that end, I'd like to share a recent rediscovery of mine, the life and ministry of the Reverend Canon Frederick Lewis Donaldson. Have you ever heard of him? Probably not. His name is now largely forgotten, but he was well known in his day. He was active as a priest, teacher, and social leader in the first decades of the last century. He has been revived largely because of his teaching and preaching on the seven social sins, more about which you'll hear in a minute. Donaldson lived from 1860 to 1953, a Church of England priest who occupied several parish and cathedral positions, including three very pure core curacies in London. He led, as a chaplain, a march for the unemployed in 1905, particularly difficult decade in British history. A march of the unemployed from Leicester to London. At Trafalgar Square, he addressed a huge gathering of the jobless. Services were held by him in Westminster Abbey and St. Paul's Cathedral for the jobless. He led a deputation of clergy to Prime Minister Asquith to demand women's suffrage. He was greatly opposed to the First World War and became active in the peace movement. So those little summaries of what he was about, from that you can see how his Christian faith helped him into causes that define his life and ministry. He served as canon at Westminster Abbey. He had a variety of positions there as well, up to and including He and his wife, Sarah Eagleston, had a long and happy marriage together. After an ordained ministry of more than 65 years, he was past 90 when he retired and became the first canon emeritus of the Abbey. He is buried along with Sarah in a side chapel of the cathedral. In a sermon on March 20th, 1925, Donaldson proposed his list of seven social sins. In an ironic twist of assumed authorship, a newspaper clipping about Donald's sermon reached Mohandas Gandhi, who published the list that same year in his Young India newspaper. Over time, it was Gandhi who became credited as the author, not Donaldson. And it is indeed in Gandhi's writings that I first came across the list, having no knowledge whatsoever of Donaldson's life. Despite that error, it is Gandhi who remains widely remembered throughout the world. And in contrast, Donaldson has been forgotten. But who was that man in the pulpit on that day? The man in the pulpit was passionate about his Christian faith. It called him to help the poor, to advance the cause of women, to criticize the conditions of war, and to call on the government to promote, by policy and law, the common good of all people. He could perhaps be deemed a Christian socialist, although Donaldson would have objected to that label. In his mind, he was first and merely a Christian. In the sermon was this list: wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, science without humanity, religion without sacrifice, politics without principle. Now, you might mull some of those. Don't worry, I'll print this all up for you so you don't have to take notes on all of those, because keep them all straight. But as they went by, did you find yourself every once in a while going, aha?
Yes.
Aha. That explains it. I hadn't thought of it that way. Well, that's exactly what it did for me. You might, of course, wonder, is there any connection between his list of seven sins and the so-called seven deadly sins? Other than the number for both the seven, the import and the impact, and indeed the presentation, are entirely different. The seven deadlies, as they're sometimes called, lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, anger, envy, pride, are a compilation of individual moral failings that were put together largely in the Middle Ages. Although their impact can ripple through the community of human relationships, their emphasis is on individual transgression. Do you all have a favorite deadly sin, or the one that maybe plagues you the most? I happen to think greed is one that leads to one of the others, but you may have a different take on that. Nonetheless, they are a list of negatives to be avoided, but believe it or not, in our prayer book, they are included not in so many words, but they're there in the litany of penitence that is part of the Ash Wednesday liturgy. Donaldson's list of social sins are just that: social failing, social conditions that can affect the common good. Each sin, if left unchecked, produces a negative effect. Donald's withouts are qualifiers that explain how a failing can infect a major sphere of human existence. So in the end, in their sinfulness, these qualities end up in opposition to human flourishing. However valuable each of these spheres may be unto themselves, none remains safe from the possibility of cheapening and corruption. And I think we see examples of that all around us. This section of the sermon, I'm indebted to the Reverend Charles Hofacker, who has been writing a lot about Donaldson and to whom I was consulting, at least online, with some of his works. And here are his kind of expansions of the seven. Wealth without work. Wealth to divide people from one another as they identify themselves according to their possessions and the amount of money that they shared work for the common good, can have an alleviating effect. The attention given to work or wealth must not deflect us from what the community's welfare requires. Work is part of the human vocation. It is not to be avoided. Pleasure without conscience. Two opposite directions are possible regarding pleasure. One is to disallow pleasure if that means that it is simply sinful, and therefore without a higher purpose we don't engage in it. That is not what God wants for us. On the other hand, to place no limits on pleasure is also sinful, for then it tempts us to substitute pleasure for God. These two directions can bypass conscience, which is the ability to make decisions that determine and end up in wise choices. Our choices are not private. They influence people and the world. We are given conscience to make careful choices. Knowledge without character. This one's going to ring true for the teachers in the room, I think. Education is not limited to transmitting information. It is essential for shaping character. Our teachers shape us in a moral way. They help us to become people. Our stories of our student years recall the personality of teachers more readily than simply the content they presented. And I have to share with you, my mom, Mrs. Bradley, was a first grade teacher back in New Hampshire. We weren't in Durham very long before we were walking down the street and I heard this voice shriek out, "Mrs. Bradley, is that you?" And it was Mrs. Bradley, and they is now an adult person, remember. Character shape for good or ill at every level of schooling and every subject area. If education is in crisis, the solution may well lie in restoring the formation of character, a development that will provide teachers and students with delight. Commerce without morality. Economics must not be determined by market forces only. Companies cannot answer simply and only to stakeholders. All people at the table, stockholders, workers, government, corporate officials, environmental advocates, all have a place. We are not simply an economy, but a society, one in which human flourishing, healthcare, education, participation, community engagement, all depend upon people engaged in commerce and morality. Science without humanity. Science appeals to our wonder and curiosity, yet all technological expertise must be governed by a humane ethic which respects every form of life and the abundance of this planet. No second planet is available for our use. Scientific enterprises must be balanced with an ethic of protecting life. The latest challenge to that? Artificial intelligence. That's the latest challenge in our community, the technological world. Religion without sacrifice. Now, I may be preaching to the choir here, or Huffaker maybe, but when we carefully analyze Christianity and what passes for Christianity, discipleship and obedience to the gospel seems to be in short supply. In its place appear substitutes, entertainment, power politics, tribalisms, maintenance rather than mission, link theologies, and an absence of imagination. Our consumer society produces consumer congregations aimed at personal satisfaction and insist in self-righteousness in an uncertain world, yet change is in the wind, and the church is changing as well. Politics without principle. Now, I don't know if I have a favorite one, but I'll have to say there's something about politics without principles that I think he hit this one on right on the head. Politics without principle. Our fears can corrupt our politics. Whether candidate, incumbent, or ordinary citizen, we may fear our opponents or even people of our own party. We fear the influence of money in politics. We regret the compromise, decency, and respect so rarely characterize relationships among elected leaders. When allegiances and loyalties are put ahead of principles, How can we arrive at meaningful solutions to our problems? It becomes discouraging to stay confident in our democracy. Yet still, democracy, like our faith, is a constant work in progress. So there is the list. Wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, science without humanity, religion without sacrifice, politics without principle. On this Labor Day weekend, we give thanks for all the work, which certainly includes us or has included us. We recall the struggles of the labor movement for fair wages and safe working conditions. We consider the history and the economic, social, and technological changes of our own time, our challenges, of course, again. This continues to our own present, for those issues of the past are the issues of the future, as the writer of Ecclesiastes reminds us. What defines the common good for all people? What provisions of the common good should be provided by a capitalist economy operating in a democratic system of government? And within that framework, how should those common goods be secured and maintained? The questions before us always, the questions before us again. I think Donaldson's list of social sins, however, is a very good place to start. I've been thinking that they would make a great study session, perhaps an Advent or Lent. Outside of the church, wouldn't it be remarkable if our legislative bodies all took a day off from deliberative sessions and instead gathered in small groups to talk about them? Wouldn't that be interesting? Yes, the social sins, their inspiration is the life, ministry, and teachings of Jesus, but there's nothing doctrinal or dogmatic about them. They're not particularly Christian, except Christian teaching inspires. Because Gandhi publicized this list, many people assumed for a long time that it was Hindu wisdom transported to the West. It is instead Christian wisdom, first announced by an Anglican priest from the pulpit of Westminster Abbey on a weekday in Lent, 1925. And like any true wisdom, it is a gift meant for one and for all. In the name of God, Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer.